Good morning and welcome to Live Dharma Sunday for Sunday, August 3rd, 2014. I'm Wendy Shinyo Hallett, sitting in for Reverend Koyo Kubose, who is traveling today. You know, I was thinking this morning, the last time I hosted the summer was the summer solstice. And boom, all of a sudden it's August and the days are getting noticeably shorter. And just this past week, I've been noticing a slight change to the color of the tree leaves and the shrubs. You know, they're sort of fading. They're not green. I mean, not all of them, but they're not as green and lush as they were just a few weeks ago. You know, it's a great time, I thought, to really watch that slow fade to fall and then the fade into winter. You know, it keeps us mindful. Nature is the reminder that life is change and life is impermanence. The other thing it is, it helps us to be mindful of things that are beautiful, even in their maybe the fade of the color. Maybe that can be beautiful. It's a change, and it's sometimes very delightful. Today, our Dharma glimpse from Douglas Sanyo Reagan Sensei reminds us of some of those times to pause and remember what a moment can be like. Douglas Sanyo is his Dharma name means brilliant sun. He was inducted as a Bright Dawn lay minister this May. He's an educator. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and he recently returned from teaching at the National Taipei University in Taiwan. So without any further delay, here's Doug for the Dharma glimpse. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you very much. We're often reminded in Buddhism to live in the moment. This comes from a self-awareness and realization that every moment is unique unto itself. We have to understand that the past is come and gone, the future yet undetermined, and there's really no way to change our past or affect our future except through mindfulness and the practice of oneness. In reality, we only have a consecutive series of individual moments, one by one, individual, unique unto itself. And it's up to us in our skillfulness in living our lives that brings us to the fruition of the perfect moment. I often think about what is the perfect moment. And for me, I've had a lot of perfect moments. The first time I fell in love, the first time I was able to see moons and planets through a telescope, to be able to hear the first time that I was ever able to deliver a baby in emergency circumstances, and hearing the joy of just laughter at something that was extraordinarily funny. Those little moments right there all remind me of a perfect moment every single day, as Venerable Gyomi Kobose says, every day is a good day. Every moment is a good moment because it has the potential to be affirming and change our lives for the better. Thank you very much. Everybody have an absolutely brilliant day.
Thank you, Douglas Sanyo. That's exactly right. Every day is a good day. I doubt if most of us would really say every moment is a perfect moment, but sometimes if we pause and relax a little bit and not think about what we're going to do next, it could be a perfect moment. You know, recently, a fellow Bright Dawn lay minister, Morris Secchio Sullivan, shared an article on his Facebook page. He shared the article, but he also shared some of his, I would say, concerns or conflicted thinking about it. And I wanted to talk about that a bit today because I think it's of interest to Buddhist practitioners, Dharma practitioners, or just anyone who's thinking about sort of the tension between spirituality and materialism in everyday life. Anyway, Moore shared this article from The New Yorker, and it was entitled Meditation for Strivers by Jacob Rubin. It's a fascinating look into sort of a growing trend of young professionals using and adopting meditation and mindfulness to advance their careers. You know, I recommend looking for the article on the web because it's interesting to think about how there's this tension between adopting the practices of a beautiful ancient comprehensive spiritual path as mere tools or technology for productivity. At best, or at worst, tools for gaining more money, power, or materials. That is, I think, what causes sort of the dismay about this article that Morris Secchio raised. You know, I think the tendency in America to adopt practices of Buddhism as a technology to improve physical and mental health emerged in this country as more and more Americans brought what they learned of the techniques of Buddhism right back into their culture. Buddhism soon became, since the past maybe 40, 50 years, 60 maybe even years, came to be seen as the anti-religion, a practice friendly to science and ultimately pragmatic. In my lifetime, I've personally watched Buddhism become an American brand that slowly transformed from a mystical and mysterious religious practice of the East, all fogged in incense, to something people do to relieve stress, to relieve pain, to cure their anxieties. And they learned these techniques by going to hospitals, community centers, and high-priced retreats, not necessarily to Buddhist centers or temples. Even knowing all that, and admittedly, I do have some mixed feelings about it, I was startled in reading this article how far this trend has advanced. I'll share a few lines from this article just so that you can get the drift. The writer, Jacob Rubin, writes about a surge, something he's noticed is a surge in articles and books, like the Nightline co-anchor Dan Harris's book called 10% Happier, which, by the way, is a New York Times bestseller, and Arianna Huffington's Thrive. And also he shared some insights from a recent Bloomberg News article reporting on how hedge fund investors are using meditation to, quote, maximize performance, unquote. So Rubin poses the question, how did strivers everywhere come to appropriate a 2,500-year-old philosophy of non-striving? He goes on to cite some passages from Harris's book, like his statement that meditation yields a good, quote, return on investment, and it's like brushing our teeth. Rubin notes that the magazine Wired called meditation the new caffeine. And he points out that many of the new brand of Buddhist practices are not only devoid of what we think that would be, mysticism, of course, and religious overtones, or spiritual overtones, but are completely, as he put it, stripped of any philosophical or ethical coding. And so then again, he asks the question, how did Buddhism get to be from the place of be here now to ROI? I think the evolution of this new brand of Buddhism as progression from spirituality to, we could say, materialism, has been part of its American journey all along. One of the first things that came to my mind when I read this article was the 1973 song called Bodhisattva from the album Countdown to Ecstasy by Steely Dan. I was, and still am, a huge Steely Dan fan. Their meticulous music production, catchy melodies, exceptional musicianship were powerfully linked to the lyrics of Walter Becker and Donald Fagen. And most of the time, these lyrics were sarcastic, and they were always wry and a bit eccentric. I was not practicing in the Dharma in 1973, but did have a few Zen books rattling around. And the snarky and cynical words that seemed to poke fun at the shallow American grasp of Buddhism were amazing to me at the time and still are. I had to go back and play it this week. I'd be playing it right now if it wasn't for rights issues, but the tune Bodhisattva is a hard-driving rock and roll piece, catchy, instrumentally brilliant. I think anybody who is a Steely Dan fan probably remembers the wonderful solos in that piece, and it's played very fast. And this reminds me of Rubin's concept of meditation for strivers. This Bodhisattva song and the tempo is fast, and it's got a striving beat. And Fagen's voice is, like, urgent. The lyrics are, for those who don't know the song, Bodhisattva, would you take me by the hand? And that's repeated. Can you show me the shine of your Japan, the sparkle of your China? Can you show me, Bodhisattva? Bodhisattva, I'm going to sell my house in town, and I'll be there to shine in your Japan, to sparkle in your China. Yes, I'll be there, Bodhisattva. I think you can see many variations of meaning in the lyrics, but one thing is sure, there are double meanings and plays on words, like the shine of your Japan, the sparkle of your China, shining, sparkling, like maybe the three jewels, but also a play on television commercials of the time, touting sparkling dishes from a certain brand of dish soap and shiny, shiny polished furniture from a certain polished brand. The implication, to me, seems to be, if I can sell my house and hang out with the Bodhisattva, then bam, perfection, enlightenment, nirvana. But also, maybe he's talking about selling his house or giving up worldly possessions. I'm sure we all bring many meanings and understandings to the lyrics, but to me, what I hear in the fast-driving beat, using rock and blues chords, which I wonder if the bluesy sound to it in parts are sort of indicating suffering. But I wonder if this is just purely sarcasm about the 60s and 70s style attraction to Buddhism as mysterious and something, well, I can just go get a snarky poke at Americans who think they can buy the package, get the quick fix, and end up being a shiny, sparkly Bodhisattva. That's sort of how I see the song, and it's entertaining for a couple of reasons, and that's one of them. But that is sort of how the Buddhist brand evolved in our country, sort of a two-track brand. The first wave of explorers going to get Buddhism in native Buddhist countries or becoming students of relocated Buddhist teachers in this country, and then the sort of evolution of that. It was repackaged by these people to meet the needs of a changing culture that became increasingly less interested in tuning out of the world or finding inner spiritual peace and increasingly more interested in conquering the outer world through career success, through money, through acquisition. So they now needed new technologies to relax, to chill, so they could be more successful in the outer world. You know, Buddhism in the West became popular precisely because it was communicated as comfortable with science, as rational, and therefore as a technology they can adapt to their own uses. At the end of the 19th century, Dharmapala from Sri Lanka, representing the Theravadin tradition, and Soyen Shaku, representing the Japanese Zen and Mahayana tradition, spoke at the World Parliament of Religions for the first time, bringing a concept of Buddhism to America. And it created quite a popular foundation for the spread of Buddhism in America. The approach Dharmapala used in speaking of Buddhism really helped to position Buddhism as a more rational religion, as say, compared to Christianity. He masterfully positioned Buddhism to a Western audience, reversing the previous concept that it was a less than religion from Western audiences, and he, as compared to Christianity, that is, and he tended to package his message full of references to science using familiar Western terms like referencing the Enlightenment and Christianity. So he really was a brilliant marketer of Buddhism in that he established the link to science and rationality at just the precise time Darwin's theory of evolution began nibbling away at the Western cultural sway of Christianity through doubts in the minds of its flock. So the link he established with his genius insight into marketing to the Western mind, marketing Buddhism, has not broken. In fact, I think it has consistently gained strength, as you can see from this article. And I point to that initial Western Buddhist marketing as the early initiation of the evolution of Buddhism in the West, an evolution that labeled Buddhism, branded Buddhism as almost anything but religion. And that label stuck, even through the second half of the 20th century when Buddhism's reach extended to a broader and broader American audience. Buddhism in all things not Western, attracted Americans, starting with the Chinese and Japanese immigration, East Asians then immigrating after the Korean and Vietnamese wars, and then the Tibetan exile, bringing us Vajrayana Buddhism. The influx of the ideas of Buddhism and any other religion but Christianity seemed to have a strong appeal during this time. It was a counterculture period of the 50s and 60s. It was reactionary, and it was questioning everything. Gradually, Buddhism took hold, and eventually Americans started going to Zen and Buddhist centers. They were taking teachings, becoming ordained as Buddhists, doing practices. Some even became monks and nuns. And the Tibetan situation helped thrust Vajrayana, or Tibetan Buddhism, and that Tibetan culture in the media limelight, and it became a cause for Americans to support. And the Dalai Lama mesmerized the consciousness of the entire American public and Hollywood, further spotlighting media attention. You know, it is written that wherever Buddhism goes, whatever culture it finds itself in, it molds itself, changing a little bit to blend the culture with Buddhism. And so it's only natural in my mind that Buddhism would become a brand, an American brand at that. And this is where I have some mixed feelings. And it's the question I sit with, as I imagine many Buddhists. I think Morris Secchio raised this in his Facebook post too, is when Buddhism becomes a brand, then have we lost Buddhism to the brand? You know, I have nothing against adopting Buddhist practices to help people in their lives. Even the Dalai Lama says if Buddhist practices make you a better Christian, then by all means that is great, but you do not have to give up your Christianity. Brand devoid of ethics. And more importantly, the question I ask, devoid of intent, has become something else. And I don't think it's Buddhism. I realize I'm using this forum today as a bit of a soapbox. But I'm wondering if maybe it's time that Buddhist teachers, Buddhist ministers, and practitioners individually discover then model a Buddhist spirituality that demonstrates the two pillars at the very foundation of Buddhism. And these pillars are wisdom and compassion. They're not about being more productive. They're not about being necessarily more relaxed. Wisdom without compassion is a cold escape from the human community. As Reverend Guillaume Kabose, our Bright Dawn lineage grandfather, wrote, "World peace begins with Gassho." Now, I don't think that is overstated. If as Buddhists we align ourselves only with the scientific platform used to market Buddhism to the West of over a century ago, we are not living our fleeting lives in a spirit of Gassho, but in a spirit of self-power, a driven life of individual achievement that ends up aligning us with the very poisons the Buddha taught us to overcome in our self-grasping. I think we are missing the message the Buddha taught in our rush to perfect ourselves, to reach the goal of enlightenment, or to better ourselves by becoming more worldly productive through practices to induce calm and mindfulness. So the question I ask about mindfulness as a brand, mindful of what? What is our aim? Is it to become something that we're not already? Is it to become something other than human beings, other than the human beings we are? You know, that isn't the message of the Buddha as I understand it. That is not the spirit of Gassho. The spirit of Gassho is accepting our own humanness, not running away from it or distancing ourselves from it. Accepting our own human confusion, our wanting, our disliking, our pain, our fear, the very thing that makes us like everything and everyone else. The Buddha's message was not about making ourselves into some kind of exceptional being, better than everyone else, but to accept that we are like everyone else and to please shed the grasping, achievement-driven self. You know, at its core, The message of the Buddha is contained in his last teaching on his deathbed, where he taught Ananda and the other bhikkhus who gathered around. He taught that they should not focus on things that are transient. They were crying and worried that he was passing on and he would leave them. And he remarked, and he taught on his deathbed. He said, "Enough, Ananda. Do not sorrow. Do not lament. Have I not already repeatedly told you that there is separation and parting and division from all that is dear and beloved? How could it be that what is born, that has come to being, that is formed and bound to fall, should not fall? That is not possible. Indeed, bhikkhus, I declare this to you. It is in the nature of all formations to dissolve. So attain perfection through diligence." The Buddha's last words are clear, that we are to work on ourselves with diligence. But what is the work that we should be doing? What is this perfection he points to? It is clear from the Buddha's words that the work he is encouraging us to do is not to perfect ourselves for the things that are bound to fall, not to try to make the impermanent things of the world permanent. No, his message is to make permanent what is impermanent. What is that? It's the perfection at our core. It's the perfection we don't quite have a grasp of yet, but it's at our core. It is our Buddha nature. Not our little small selves, but our potential great self as a Buddha or Bodhisattva. You know, as a Mahayana Buddhist who took Bodhisattva vows, I believe it is our intent that makes the difference. I believe at the heart of the whole practice is intent. It's not about the result, but about our intent and the mere fact that we try. After all, the Bodhisattva vows are really essentially impossible. Part of the vows are, however innumerable all beings are, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible my delusions are, I vow to extinguish them all. You know, not taken literally, this is impossible to fulfill as humans. But these are ideals. Clearly, not the ideals of the strivers Jacob Rubin wrote about in The New Yorker, but different ideals. Ideals centered on the other as being as important as ourselves. Ideals based on kindness, compassion, and true wisdom, and not necessarily intelligence. As Mahayanists, wisdom and compassion are inseparable. They're the two pillars, but they're really one. It's like two sides of a coin. Wisdom and the discernment achieved from meditating on our Buddhist teachings shows us that the true nature of reality is that the concept of separate beings is really an illusion. Actually, it's delusional. So paradoxically, a person who takes bodhisattva vows or has even had the intent or thought to be a bodhisattva can see that there are actually no beings to save. In the Diamond Sutra, it says that we cannot lead all beings to liberation because there are no beings to liberate. This realization arises from an understanding of shunyata, an understanding of interdependence, that there is no discrete one thing that is discrete and individual from everything else. So now that we have these bodhisattva ideals, what do we do with them? How do we practice a true, non-branded Mahayana Buddhism? It is as simple and as difficult as maintaining a spirit of kindness and open-heartedness. And we will often fall short of accomplishing this. Well, I'll speak for myself. I often fall short of accomplishing this. But the important thing is to make the effort. Or, as Reverend Koyo Kobosi teaches, means equal end. This is not about being nice all the time. Sometimes a wise bodhisattva response is to be firm. It is not about saving the world through grand selfless gestures. But it's clear from the Buddha's last words and the Bodhisattva vow that the emphasis is ourselves, focusing on our motivations, intentions, and preoccupations in a detached and discerning way so that we can see ourselves and see others clearly and respond with both wisdom and compassion. And you know, as some Buddhist blogger said, and I'll leave you with this line, although I can't remember his name right now, and I really wish I could because it's a great line. It is our bodhisattva duty to save all beings from ourselves. So beyond the brand and underneath the label our culture has slowly been applying to Buddhism, we, as practitioners, as bodhisattvas in training, can demonstrate in our everyday lives what it's really about. Just remember what has become a code phrase for me. Please let me save all beings from myself. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us, and make it a great day while remembering your new bodhisattva duty.